Many people in this day and age that we live in all ages past, and I'm sure in ages future, will be called people who are overlooked. The people that we walk by every day, that we just look on over them and go on by, due to their insignificance in society, maybe even their insignificance as people see them sometimes in the church. They're the people who very seldom do anything to draw attention to themselves. Often they're the ones, they're just not considered important by those who feel like they're very important. That's usually the way it goes. We have a tendency to overlook those sometimes who are disabled, some of those who are mentally and physically challenged. And we overlook those in the daily ministries of the church. They have been since the church started and will be until he comes back for us. But Jesus always sees something eternally important in every individual. I thank God that he sees us one by one. And not just as a conglomeration. He sees each one of us. Saved us all one by one. And I want to start off talking about some of the people in the Bible who were overlooked. But let me give you an illustration and a true one at this. She was 84 years old in the city of St. Louis. She belonged to a denominational organization. She had 13 children, 47 grandchildren, 28 great-grandchildren, and 18 great-great-grandchildren. This was a lady that was really known. At the age of 80, she was poor. She was ironing clothes at a laundromat for 10 cents apiece off of Cherokee Street in St. Louis. In the winter of 1980, she was found dead in her apartment. They had not seen her at her church building for 4 or 5 days, and they had services 5 days out of 6 or out of 7. The man who had left his clothes with her hadn't found his clothes lately. They began to ask around, where might she be? She had children who lived within a mile of her. She had grandchildren who lived within a mile or two. Nobody knew where she was, but they found her dead in her apartment with no heat. They checked with the utilities company. She had had no heat in a month. She had had no electricity in a month. There was nothing in the refrigerator but an empty carton and half an apple. And she had a diary that she wrote in every day. And there was only one entry in it. Nobody came today. With all of that family, my grandmother died in a frozen flat in St. Louis. I was in the United States Army serving in Korea. But her family, her children, were very close by. Broke my heart that nobody, even from her religious organization, missed her. She was overlooked. She came and went out of that building, I know, because when I came back from Vietnam in 1969, and I stayed with my grandmother for 2 weeks, out of 14 days, we were in her church building 13 days. She was always there, but yet nobody missed her when she didn't show. Nobody went by to check on her. A man who had hired her to iron his clothes asked about her, and that's how they found her. Overlooked. Happens in life every day. You can pick up your paper at a lot of the obituaries that you read that are one-liners and three-liners. They're overlooked. You never hear about these people. And you think, well, maybe they never did anything important. I don't believe that any human being that exists is an accident. They're all an intent of God. And sometimes the intentions of God do not get fulfilled because people choose the wrong way to go. Can't blame God for it, but I want to make sure that you and I are never those people who pass by the others, whom society has called insignificant or unimportant, and we overlook them. In the book of Mark, chapter 5, in verses 1 through 20, was a man, and I'm sure the people had had enough of him. He was demon-possessed. He had so many demons in him, he called him Legion. That's 10,000. A legion is 10,000. And this man, if you could get this picture of this crazed, ranting man rushing down the hill at you, screaming at the top of his lungs, plunging down the slope towards you, out of his mind. And I'm sure the people of that village where he lived, in the Gadarenes, had seen this man many times. They'd had it with him. Anymore, Oh, that's just that nut that lives out there amongst the tombs. Oh, that's that crazy guy out there. That's that demon-possessed guy. Nobody gave him any more credence, for he didn't fit their mold anymore. He just didn't click the way they thought he should click. So he became an overlooked. But you see, to Jesus and his disciples, especially to Jesus, not so much to the disciples, because they didn't know what to do with this guy. They were afraid. But Jesus stood firm and ordered them demons to come out of this man. And the possessed man, he knew of his destitute state. He even knew about Jesus. But he feared all of the challenges of a responsible new life. Somewhat fearful of those things, but Jesus gave this man in abundance that which he feared probably the most. But he wanted to share it with everybody in those 10 Grecian cities on the other side of that river. He wanted to share everything. He wanted to go with Jesus when he was healed of that, because you see, Jesus saw him as significant. And he understood that the Lord saw him as significant and not unimportant and not a person to be overlooked. You know, this kind of event changes, it does mine anyway, my value system. And maybe going to another culture might help us a little bit, because there was an instance where the Bible was being translated into one of the native Indian languages of South America. And the man who was in there trying to do the translation was using this story in his teaching. And when he came to this part about these 2,000 swine that were being cast, or these 2,000 swine that were there, that the demons were going to leave this man and go into those swine, and then those swine all went into the water. This villager said he was amazed at this, because they didn't even have a word for 2,000. They had a word for one, they had a word for two, and then they had a word for many. But they didn't deal with things like thousands, so he had no word for 2,000. So he asked the translator, and he was trying to get a handle on this, so he had a lot of lengthy discussion about it. As the tribesman was trying to grasp the size of this herd of pigs, and that many pigs, it just flabbergasted him. He was totally astonished. And he asked, he said, did Jesus really exchange all those wonderful pigs for one human? He said, that's what he did. He sure did. He said, in our culture, if you want the life of another man, it'll cost you one pig. It was time for the translator to be astonished. Whew. A pig was worth the life of a human. Made me stop and think how much Jesus loved that man who was possessed. 2,000 pigs meant nothing to the saving of one soul. Wouldn't you hate to be the guy that overlooked him? And then Jesus turned around and said, wait a minute, he's worth at least 2,000 pigs, if not a whole lot more. He was an overlooked man. Further down in Mark chapter 5, verse 24, is an overlooked woman. She was a woman who for 12 years had had a hemorrhage of blood. And you know, after all, what could a young carpenter know about healing people? Doctors had all failed. No one was able to assist her. What could anyone hope from him when doctors over and over and over again had repeatedly failed in stopping this woman from bleeding? And by the way, because she was bleeding, she was unclean to everybody around her, because she had an issue of blood. She wasn't even supposed to be out among the good people. She wasn't supposed to make contact with any of the good people. So she became, because of her station of life and this affliction that she had, an overlooked individual. You know, a lot of life's battles do that to you. They nick at your edges. They nibble away at the edge. Not strong enough to kill you. Just those things that irritate you and pester you every day. They just eat away and eat away a little bit at a time. They use our energy. They use our money. They cloud our joy. And this woman had had a lot of demoralizing days. 12 times 365. And she had had that many demoralized days of being a woman of uncleanness. And yet she came. She came. What a move. Despite her weakness, despite being despised, despite being overlooked, she gets out of her sick bed and she gets out of that crowd. And don't you know, if they would have known that she was the woman who was unclean and everybody she was bumping out of her way, they're unclean for 7 days right there. They're all worried about unclean, but they weren't worried about the woman. She pushed her way through that crowd to get to Jesus. She pushed through him because she believed there was no problem that he could not heal. He had healed others. Why can't he heal me? He cleansed others. Why can't he cleanse me? He cleansed lepers. I heard about it. Oh, I know only one went back to thinking. But he cleansed them all the same. And how desperate this woman must have been when all of this is weighing on her and there's nothing of hope. She doesn't have any anymore until she sees this person, Jesus. And she's heard of the hope that others have gained. Why can't I have it in him as well? I think he can do something. I believe he can do something. And her hopelessness can be the beginning of a new search of life. And if we'll just meet people that way, in their midst of their hopelessness, and give them hope in life. Met a man 2 weeks ago. Lives over in Boynton Beach. Some people call it a lucky meeting. I call it the intent of God. I don't believe as Christians we ever have accidents anymore. They're just incidents to be used to his glory. So I don't have any accidents. And this couple that met him, this mother and her daughter who lived there in a 55 and older community, happened to see this man across the street with his father who lived there. And the daughter struck up a conversation with him. He began to tell her how miserable his life was, how everything had gone wrong. His wife had left him. He had lost his job. He was living in the guest quarters of his sister's house and just had nothing but a one room to live in. But he was thankful for that. And she said, "You need to meet our preacher." And I said, "No, you need to meet Jesus. And I'm here to introduce you to him." And we had our first Bible study Thursday night. And he's just so hungry for the Word of God. He can't believe what he studied the first time. He can't believe that's really there and it's all for him. No one had ever told him that before. Because see, he was overlooked. And this woman had been overlooked. But she had this outstretched hand of faith. The story of this hemorrhaging woman really shows how an outstretched hand of faith can open doors to a dramatic life-changing event. That when you reach out in faith to Jesus, he reaches out to you. Listen, the minute she touched Jesus, he knew it. He said, "Who touched me?" You got hundreds of people around you saying, "Who touched me?" Because see, there was a difference in the word he used, touched. Because he said this one, power went out from him. That's what happens when you and I exercise our faith. When the insignificant of the world and the passed over, the overlooked of the world, when they reach out and touch Jesus, power comes out from him. That's God. And power comes out from him. And power went out from Jesus. And he knew it. When this touch came to me, power went out from me. And the woman's healed. Wow. Jesus changed a situation that had been a problem for 12 years. And no one had an answer. They took her money. A lot of folks will do that. They'll take your money. They got every scheme in the books going on. They'll take your money. And they took this woman's money and they promised her a lot, but they delivered nothing. Jesus took nothing from her, but gave her everything with that one healing touch. Oh, to be like him, blessed Redeemer. This is my constant longing and prayer, that I'll not look at anyone as I walk through this life and see them as insignificant and be the one who says, "I overlooked them rather than looking for them." Listen, there was a man by the name of Greg Krebs, and his wife, Julie, had a baby. Several months into the pregnancy, they were told there was going to be some problems with the baby. They did an amniocentesis and determined the baby was going to be, as they like to say, retarded. And they recommended they go ahead and abort the child. He said, "I can't do that. Our relationship with God prohibits us from doing such a thing as murdering a child." And they went ahead and gave birth to that little baby. They said they couldn't name him Christ, so they named him Chris. That's as close as they could get, they felt like. And one day, Greg and Chris, when Chris was 6 years old, his mother was a nurse. His wife was a nurse, by the way. So they went to the hospital to pick up his wife, Julie. And she wasn't quite on time, so they sit there in a waiting area. And while they were sitting there waiting, an elderly gentleman came in. His clothes were not clean at all. Gave off a pretty foul odor about him. And everybody in the waiting room could smell him. And Greg got up to go ask the receptionist over there when his wife would be down. Could she call upstairs and find out? And when he turned around, his little boy was over there sitting with this old fella. And the old man had his head down in his hands and he was crying. And he came over to the man. He says, "Sir, I am so sorry if my little boy has offended you." And he said, "Offended me? Offended me? This is the first human being in 20 years that's hugged me." He said, "I then realized my little boy had a better idea of what it is to be Christ-like than I had and showed me a much better way." She said, "Be led by a child." That ought to be in the book somewhere. "And a child shall lead them." You know, when you think about people like that, that nobody wants to be with them because you get close and they reek of an odor. My wife and I know about this. We had dear friends up in Indiana. She raised dogs in her home. Melanie did, and Gary. And they had an odor about them that drove everyone away. And I met them. And met them at their shop, and she was doing work to help people with disabilities. And people would come in, and they would hurry out the door. And you'd see them when they come out going, whew. And I went in there. First time I met them, it was a stench that actually burned your nostrils. Because it was uric acid from urine. And the animals were in her office, the animals were in her home, and her home smelled. She bleached her home, it didn't help. But their souls. And my wife and I started a Bible study with her and her husband. And we baptized them into Jesus and brought them to the church building. And they sat down and people got up and moved. They noticed it, but we didn't. We sat right there with them. We hugged them. We loved on them and let them know that they're children of God. Now, as time went by, we were able to help her and him. Not even 6 months later, Gary died of a heart attack. Melanie lasted another year and a half. She couldn't live without Gary. She died. But we had people in the church. It broke my heart. Got up and moved away and came to us and said, "We met your smelly friends." I said, "You met my smelly friends?" I said, I beg your pardon. You met Jesus' children. You met his bride. And if she didn't suit your nostrils, you take it up with Jesus. You can do something about your nostrils if you have to, but that's your brothers and sisters. Paul said in the book of 1 Corinthians, there was a few wise, a few noble, a few of status. Brothers and sisters, the rest of them were called the offscouring of the earth. They were our brothers and sisters. This woman with a hemorrhage was much like Gary and Melanie, the offscouring of the earth. Nobody wanted anything to do with her. She was overlooked. But Jesus, he saw something in this woman of greatness because she had more faith than the whole crowd following. Most everybody just followed along for a touch of Jesus here and there. But she followed along to touch Jesus. And she got what she came after, no matter how many people overlooked her. And then on in John chapter 4, you find that Samaritan woman. Oh, this lady, I tell you, this Samaritan woman, a member of the hated mixed race of Jewish people married into the people they were in captivity with, known to be living in sin. She had already had five husbands. She's living with a guy practicing the 90s, you know, just living together. And virtually any and every Jewish man knew better than to even talk with a woman in the streets, much less a Samaritan woman, about religious matters as well as that, you know, and talking about the things of God and the values of the gift of God. But the woman came to the well with shame on her mind. She came to the well already knowing what she was. She wasn't liked in the community. She was overlooked by everybody in the community. Nobody wanted to help this woman. It's the heat of the day. Listen, I've been to the Middle East. They do not draw water in the middle of the day unless there's a crisis going on. The women go to the wells at 4 o'clock in the morning. They help each other. They draw up their water and they help each other with their pots. And they leave. This woman's out there all by herself in the heat of the sun. So I know she wasn't thought very well of in the community. She was a woman of low esteem. She was a woman of ill repute. She was a woman that nobody wanted anything to do with. And she had a man living in her house, probably had to have him there so she could buy and sell because you had to have a male name to live under. And that's the only reason she was living with this guy. But she'd already been through five husbands, so nobody liked her. But Jesus talked to her. The disciples couldn't believe it when they came back. Jesus spoke to this woman. He saw something promising within her. He saw something to be renewed within this woman. He saw something in this woman to be reclaimed for God. So he spoke insightfully of some of the most profoundly spiritual and far-reaching things. As a matter of fact, she, as far as I can find out, is the first one he said, "I'm the Messiah to." Very special. He looked beyond all the prohibitive cultural obstacles, all the religious pretensions that people had, and all of the moral debauchery and claiming a believer who would influence a town. Now you get this picture. Nobody liked that woman. Everybody that see her, I'm sure, is, you know, how we used to do that. Shame, shame, shame. Nobody wanted anything to do with her. But what thrills me is when I teach evangelism, I use this woman as a great illustration. Because this is one woman of low esteem, ill repute, nobody liked, everybody shunned her, and she got excited about Jesus. Because she said, this guy told me everything I ever did. He only told her, you got five husbands, and a man you're living with now, you're not married to him. Well, if he knows that, he knows everything else, doesn't he? I mean, what would you guess he doesn't know? He knows it all. So she runs back into town, tell him, I met a man that told me everything I ever did in my life. He knows it all. And she's all excited. What does the village do? Because this woman doesn't talk to people in the village. They beat feet, get in the village. They go out to find his well. Where is this guy? And they plead with him to stay around longer. Now, when they leave, they come back to the woman. I like that. Now we also believe, not just because of your word, because now we have also heard. But they would have never heard if they hadn't got that one insignificant, overlooked woman. See what Jesus does with the insignificant and the overlooked? He raises them up. And we better be in the business of Jesus and raising them up. Instead of going off to some place looking for the high and mighty, I was preaching in the city of Dumas, Texas. We baptized 52 people there the first year I was there as the evangelism minister. One of the deacons of the church came to me. He said, you know, you're bringing too many of the wrong kind of people in here. I said, I beg your pardon, John. He said, yeah. I said, what do you mean wrong? I got scales, pointed ears, forked tongues. What do you mean wrong kind of people? He said, well, you know, the other side of that track over there. Oh, I said, you mean the poor? Well, they're the ones that need to hear the good news. He said, well, why don't you come over where I live and evangelize? I said, could God put you there to do that? He said, well, I'm too busy to get out and do that. I said, you better get unbusy then, because God put you in that neighborhood to evangelize them. I said, I'll tell you this much. Jesus tried for 3.5 years to convince and convict a bunch of self-righteous Jews of their need for God in their life, and he couldn't do it. If you think you can do any better, you help yourself. Because I found with a bunch of rich people, it's really hard to convince them of their need for Christ. When I knocked on the door next door to John, and a man said, I got all this without Jesus. What do I need him for? And I got off his porch real quick, looked around. Weather looked good, so I thought I'd make it out of there. Don't want to be around people like that, see? When you think you're so good, you don't need Jesus. You're already in trouble. You just don't know it. And this woman at the well, she knew she was in trouble. She knew she had problems. But she also wanted this water that he had. This water where I'll never be thirsty again. And so what Jesus isn't to this woman and to all of us and to the insignificant and the overlooked of the world, Jesus relates to all of us without any limitations. He's never tired. He's never distant. He's never distracted. I love that part about Jesus. He's not limited by time. He's not limited by space. He's not limited at all. He's present in all of his people. And he can't be destroyed and he can't be overpowered. It's been tried. And they all failed. Instead of going to the main post office, Mamie Adams always went to the little local post office branch because she said the postal employees were very friendly. She went there to buy stamps just before Christmas one year, and the line was extremely long. And one of the people in line said to her, Miss Adams, there's a machine right over there. You can go and you can buy your stamps right out of that machine. She said, I know, but I don't want to go. And they said, why is that? She said, because that machine won't ask me about my arthritis. That's why she didn't go downtown to the big post office. The little post office, people were personable. Miss Adams, Miss Mamie, how's your arthritis today? And she could tell them all about it. See, and she felt better. Somebody considered her significant at that little post office. Sometimes you get in the big cities, you're not significant anymore. Sometimes you get in the so-called big cities, you're not significant anymore. If you don't have a name that's in the news in some great way, you're not significant anymore. But to Jesus, everybody is significant, including the woman in John chapter 8 who was caught in adultery. Of all the circumstances to be caught in, this woman is caught in adultery. She's given up hope. She's living in a day and a time when women were cattle or chattel anyway. They were treated like property, be used and thrown away if you wanted to. Men were divorced of their wives for any and every reason that they could think of, from burning the toast to branding the wrong meal. Yeah, just whatever they wanted to get away with, they could do that. And this woman is caught in the act of adultery. The problem is the people who brought her to Jesus are trying to get Jesus trapped. They don't care about this woman's adultery. If they had, they would have brought her to Jesus. They'd have taken her to the magistrates or to the priest. But instead, they would rather try to entrap Jesus. So they bring her and say, we caught this woman in the very act of adultery. What do you say about her? Now, if Jesus says stone her, they got him because, see, you're supposed to bring both parties for judgment. And if he says let her go, well, then he's not exacting the punishment that Leviticus said under the law, that she's to be stoned to death. So they think they got him in one of those perennial traps that they never get caught in, but Jesus doesn't get caught in traps. I like what this says. He just kind of bent down there and wrote something in the sand. Did you ever ask yourself, what did he write? I don't know. I wasn't there. But I tried to read myself into the scripture, and knowing my Savior Jesus the way I know him now versus the way I thought I knew him a long time ago, I could almost see him just kneel down in the sand and write out in Hebrew, where is the man? I could just see that. I know how Jesus operates because I read his book. Where is the man? And look up. You know, he asking that question about John's baptism. Was that from God or man? We don't know. Liar, liar, pants on fire, right? They knew. They couldn't answer it either way because they knew they were trapped. So he says, well, where are those who condemn you? Where are your accusers? She said, I haven't. He said, I don't accuse you either. Go your way and sin no more. Look what he did. He looked at this woman, and he saw a woman maybe one day who would be a wonderful wife, who would be a great grandmother, maybe a woman who would lead many others into his kingdom. And I believe she might have done just exactly that. But to everybody else, she was insignificant. A life to be thrown away that day at the accusations of a couple of self-righteous Pharisees, but overlooked and insignificant. And how about that young man born blind in John 9? Boy, if he wasn't insignificant. Blind people, you know, in Middle Eastern countries this day, if you see a cripple lying on the street and you're walking through there, do not be surprised if people walk over and kick him. Yeah, literally kick the blind man or the cripple and say, hey, can I be better than Allah? Allah made him that way, so, you know, who am I? I got to go over and at least kick the guy to show I'm not, you know, trying to make myself look better than Allah. They can have Allah. I'll take Elohim every day. He's my God and Jesus Christ. See, because Jesus reaches out to blind people. Jesus reaches out to lepers. Jesus did, you know, Jesus never touched a leper to heal one. He touched him, but he didn't touch him to heal him. He touched him because that's what a leper needs. Of all things that a leper needs is somebody to touch one of them. And I don't mean like this. Jesus reached out and touched him with a healing hand, that loving hand. He could have just said healed and all lepers were healed just that quick. He touched lepers because they needed to be touched. He helped this woman. He helped this blind man because he needed to be touched. And the people couldn't believe that he was healed. People couldn't understand. Even his mother and father said, hey, he's our son, but he's old. You take get your answers from him. We're not going to jump in on his fight. And they said, well, maybe you call him a sinner. You can call him what you want, but does God hear sinners? God hears this guy because this guy prayed to God. God says, God, this man healed me. But blind men like beggars sit on the side of the street every day. And no one come by to give them anything. Or if they did, it was just a small pittance of anything that they had. Brother Richard Rogers told me a story one time when they were in India. And every day he would go by and the guy would beg, Pasa Master, Pasa, Pasa Master, Pasa. And he said, every day I give him a whole rupee. He said, this went on for about 6 months, 7 months. And finally he started to put a rupee in. The guy said, wait a minute, wait a minute. He said, do you not understand that this little coin does not buy what it used to buy 7 months ago? And this coin is not as valuable as it once was. He said, if you can't give more than this, you go find yourself another beggar. Now, see, this guy wasn't a real poor person. He was a guy that was a professional beggar. There's a big difference in the people in need and the people in greed. And Richard was trying to help a man he thought was in need. He said, found out right then he was in greed. So I told everybody around, quit giving him money. So they found out who he was. There may be people out there like that, but Richard didn't know until he found out himself. But you see, people sit on the side of the road and beg for a reason. We have them all over here. That's one of the things that impressed Gene and I with the area when we came here, is the people at every overpass, at every corner, at every great intersection, big intersection, people are there begging. Some of them are really in need. Some of them are not in need. Some of them have been seen driving a brand new Lexus because that's how they're making their payments on it, begging. They had a news article on where some of these people are making $300 to $400 a day begging. They're professionals. And the law lets them do that. We're not talking about those people. Those aren't the overlooked that Jesus is talking about. Now, those people need to know Jesus as well. They need to know Jesus. Let me give you one more fellow. This lesson will be yours. His name was Zacchaeus. In the book of Luke in chapter 19, this is a wee little guy. The children all sang of the wee little man named Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus wasn't a guy to get caught up in all the crowds because he couldn't see over them. You wouldn't find Zacchaeus in a big crowd of people walking down the street because he couldn't see over the top of anybody get trampled on. So Zacchaeus wanted to see Jesus, so he climbed up in a tree, and Jesus made an appointment with him that day. When Jesus saw him, he said, Zacchaeus, that's a name, come down from where you are, because I have to go to your house today. When he went to Zacchaeus' house, without solicitation, Zacchaeus, I think, found something within himself, as Jesus found it within him as well. And he says, this day I'll give half of my belongings to the poor. Nobody told him he had to do that. And then he made a statement that I would find, and maybe you would too, very difficult if you were a tax collector and looking right into the face of Jesus. And you said, and if I have defrauded anybody, I'll pay back fourfold. If. A tax collector said, if. Y'all laugh because tax collectors always seem to get plenty. And this one said, if I've exacted more than I should, I'll pay back fourfold. You remember what Jesus said to that man? That nobody liked. Listen, tax collectors were hated by their own people. Because, see, they were taking money from their brethren and giving it to the Romans, the occupying army. Nobody liked them. Even the Romans didn't like them because they said, you're turncoats to your own people. So the Romans didn't trust them. Their own people didn't trust them. Nobody liked them. I'm sure dogs would just bite them anyway. Nobody would like. These are the kind of guys that if they called their dogs, they wouldn't come to them. Somebody else would have called the dog for them. But this guy says, I'll give half everything I own to the poor. If I've cheated anybody, I'll pay them back fourfold. And Jesus says, salvation has come to this house today. Would you please remember, brothers and sisters, that wherever you carry Jesus Christ, whatever home you walk into, you have brought salvation with you. You've brought it with you. You think about Jesus now. Just give some consideration about him. If we would be followers of Jesus, then we must choose the lifestyle of Jesus. We must choose the walk style of Jesus. Thinking like Jesus, feeling like Jesus, acting like Jesus. That's more than 10 words. But we've got to be these kind of people. We really must. His vision, his purposes must be our vision and our purposes. His values, his choices, his attitudes must be those of ourselves as well. And his reactions must be our reactions because they really begin to describe his lifestyle. When you think about Jesus, it was a lifestyle in which material attractions did not dominate his decisions. Yet he owned a valuable, seamless garment that he wore. It was a lifestyle in which natural pleasures of marriage and intimacy gave way to eternal purposes of God, though loyal relationships and his friends were very, very important to him. Jesus' lifestyle was one in which a longing for longevity of life did not crowd out kingdom priorities, though he dealt wisely in the care and the keeping of his own body. It was a lifestyle in which power, control, and applause gave way to serving people. Not rich people, fishermen, tax collectors, and prostitutes, though he was destined to be the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. It was a lifestyle in which he and those that followed him had little hope of even surviving, though eternal reward was all of their pursuits. It was a lifestyle in which he did not allow his circumstances to shape his goals, although he saw in his circumstances the very reasons and purposes for his life upon this earth. It was a lifestyle in which he embraced the largeness of God's eternal purposes, though he never overlooked the simple lessons that he saw among the people. You see, Jesus' lifestyle wasn't intended to be caught up satisfying himself. He said, I didn't come to do my will. I came to do the will of him who sent me. The words I speak, these are the words that he gave me. They're not mine. His lifestyle kept true to the vision and the focus that he started with and he ended with. He never overlooked the overlooked. But he gave them what they needed. And he gave it in abundance. Just as John 10:10 said, I came that you might have life and that you might have it abundantly. We must begin to look at people the way Jesus looked at them. Not tomorrow. Not tomorrow. Today. Tomorrow, he promised his conscience. Tomorrow, I'm going to start to do good. Tomorrow, I'll live like I ought to. Tomorrow, I'll live like I should. Tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow. Day after day it went on. Tomorrow, 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 till youth with his passion was gone. Till age and wisdom with wrinkles had furrowed the lines on his brow. And then out of the shadow stepped death with that pitiable syllable, now. Brothers and sisters, we have to start today. Can't start tomorrow. Start today. There's somebody that you've overlooked. Go to them. Raise them up to Jesus. You know of somebody that seems insignificant? Person them. Oh, when I went to Indiana, there was a little fellow there that I loved dearly, and I get emails from him all the time. I call him a young guy, but he's 56 years old. His name is Billy Gore. And Billy was insignificant to the people there in Anderson. He'd had polio when he was a child. His body wasn't formed the way bodies should be formed. And he sat over to the side, but he loved Jesus. Billy had so many medications that he had to take that oftentimes he would almost fall off a pew asleep. But he loved Jesus and he wanted to be there. And I began to meet with Billy and his mother Mary. His dad had died many, many years ago. And as Gene and I met with him and his mother Mary, that's a wonderful lady. She was 78 years old and she was taking care of a woman who was 82. Giving health care to her and taking care of her in her home every day. It's the only way she had to make money. Doing everything she could do. And poor little Billy would sit in the worship services. Mary's legs were infected, so she had a hard time getting around. But poor Billy, and the guys would say to me, I said, well, do y'all ever use Billy for prayer? Oh, no, no, no. That's just Billy. We love Billy, but just leave Billy alone. See, he was insignificant. And I said, no, this can't be. He's God's child. There's no insignificant children of God. There's no insignificant people. So I began to visit with Billy, and I began to tell Billy what he could do. Billy said, you know, I'd like to learn computer. But I said, fine. I had an old computer. I went and give it to him. Set it up and began to teach him how to use a computer. And he's a go-getter on a computer today. He's just having a ball with it. Emails everybody in the world, I think, that he can find to listen to him about Jesus. But I got Billy to stand up and lead a prayer one Sunday. Billy leads songs. Billy leads prayer. Billy does the communion table. Leads the table. Billy's all involved now. Billy is not significant. And Billy knows it, and he'll tell you, I'm a child of the King. And kings don't have insignificant kids. And God doesn't have any grandchildren either. They're all just children. And Billy's significant, and Mary's significant. And we did our best to, what I like to call, person him. Because we love him, still do. I hear from him every week, at least two or three times a week. I get an email and an update on he and his mom, Mary. All it takes is one of us to go and help somebody who feels insignificant. Because they feel insignificant because we've helped them to feel that way. Society has. Maybe even the church has. And it's time we go to those people and help them to realize you're not insignificant. You're my brother. You're my sister. Your father is my father. We're children of the King. Pray with me if you would. Almighty merciful God, we're so grateful that your loving Son Jesus came to this earth and gave us the example to follow and showed us how to walk among the great and the small. And that, Father, he's taken all of us and added us to his bride and given us significance that we could have never had in this universe without him. Though undeserving as we may be, Father, because we've sinned and fall short of your glory, you in your wisdom chose us, elected us, and personed us. Father, may we follow the example of Christ and never look upon another human being as insignificant or meaningless to us, but to see within them the salvation of a soul, of a human created in your image. Father, we ask that you would bless us all here tonight and those who have been so attentive in these lessons that have been given, and all of the speakers as well, Father. Bless us as we prepare to leave this place and go to these things we call houses to live in, Father. And bless us as we worship you this week. But may your Spirit guide us to those that the world sees as insignificant, that we might bring them all to Christ. In his name we pray. Amen. Thank you, brothers. Appreciate it.